Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Under pressure. Da-da, da-da,
da-da, da-da. Dance.
Almost on the right beat. Hello, everyone. I'm Kimberly Adams. Welcome back to Make Me Smart, where we make today make sense. It is Friday, March 29th.
And I'm Nova Safo, in for Kai Rizdal. Thanks for joining us on the podcast and on the YouTube stream. It's Friday, and that means it's time for our weekly Happy Hour episode.
Exactly. And because it is Friday, that means we're going to do some news. We're going to take a break and then play a round of half full, half empty. But of course, we have to start with our drinks. Nova, what are you drinking?
Oh, okay. I have today
champagne, right?
a simple Sauvignon Blanc, actually. A simple Sauvignon Blanc. It is from the California Central Coast. Justin is the brand, is the label
okay.
We're looking at. It's a
Have you had it before in most places.
I have had it before. It's a pretty standard Sauvignon Blanc. Very nice, you know, very, you know, like balanced well. And it's one of those nice, simple pleasures you can enjoy in Pasadena on a, I'm not in Pasadena, but, you know, little old lady in Pasadena, there's nobody meaner. That was the reference there. So, no, nothing.
He's
Sauvignon Blancs.
Little old lady from Pasadena.
Dun, dun, no, there you go.
We have right all the song
Colorado
lyrics.
Colorado Boulevard.
No, it was funny. Earlier we were talking about champagne supernova in the sky because you're Nova. Now we've got the little old lady from Pasadena. I feel like this
we'll
is
have to keep
be
the references
the, like,
coming. Yeah.
The Name That Tune episode of Make Me Smart.
Indeed. And how about you, Kimberly? What you got mixed up today?
So I went to an event earlier this week with responsibility.org because we're getting ready to head into Alcohol Awareness Month. And they were handing out these little guides of cocktails. And, you know, if you give me a recipe, I'm going to try it. So this one was Garden Collins, which has non-alcoholic gin or any other white spirit of your choice. As anyone who watches the show knows, I think gin is the devil. I don't even mess with non-alcoholic gin. So I used my non-alcoholic tequila, lemon juice, simple syrup, matcha. Yeah, it actually has matcha in it. Your choice of garden herbs. I used rosemary, club soda, and garnish with a mint sprig and a dehydrated lime wheel, which randomly I had a dehydrated lime wheel, and it looks like this. Oh, wait, my camera's there. Look how pretty it is.
That is a very beautifully done cocktail. Looks gorgeous.
Thank you.
And but the moment of truth, how does it taste?
It's good. I tasted it earlier, and I felt like I wanted to add a little bit of something, so it's not fully non-alcoholic. I added some lambic that I got in Croatia, believe it or not, when I was on an awful cruise with my family. But I did bring back lambic, which is a type of liquor.
So it made up for it.
No, not in the tiniest bit. The lambic is good, but this, God help me, that was a bad cruise. Anyway, so I added lambic to it, but it's really tasty. And I realized that I forgot to add club soda, but otherwise, it's delicious. Hey. All right, let's see what everybody else is drinking. Nova, I know you have the YouTube chat up, so you look at YouTube and I'll look at Discord.
Oh, we have a Discord thing too? I didn't even know that.
Oh, yeah, there's a fan-organized Discord channel.
We have Miller Lite. That's not acceptable. Please go get something else. White Sangria. That's okay. That we'll accept that.
We don't judge Kiwana. People's drinks here, Nova.
Oh, I judge everything. That's changing immediately. So, Kiwana Lily Koi Daiquiri, Tangerine Margarita. Now, that sounds lovely.
Okay.
I'd go for a Coke Zero with a hot dog. I'm not going to say anything about that.
Bob in the Discord is drinking a Sangiovese that looks quite delicious.
What's the label?
Let's see. It says Lulio. I can't quite No, I don't know how to read that. Bob, help me out here. Mm. All right, we should get to some news. Nova, what news did you bring today?
There's this interesting tug of war going on around this merger deal between U.S. Steel and Nippon Steel, which isn't a Japanese company. Until recently, I didn't realize that Nippon actually means Japan in Japanese.
Because you don't watch enough anime.
Is that right?
Yes, that's exactly the reason why.
Well, there you go. Can you ever not watch enough anime? I lost my train.
Sorry, Nova.
It's going to be one of those episodes.
How much wine did you have before the show?
Not any. I didn't do All right, so the deal
Are
is
you serious?
There's all these factions happening around this deal. Senator Sherrod Brown, Steelworkers Union, coming out against Nippon Steel buying U.S. Steel. They want to keep it American. Biden has come out and said he's, very recently, I think sometime earlier this month, said, I'm not so sure about Nippon Steel buying U.S. Steel. You know, this whole idea of us trying to keep kind of important industries kind of, I guess, in American hands. I'm not sure exactly what the objection is, because they're still would be based here. So that has raised the alarm of the auto industry, because the other candidate is Cleveland-Cliffs out of Cleveland, Ohio. Sherrod Brown, coincidentally, is the Ohio senator. So they just came out with a letter, open letter, to the administration saying, if you're not going to approve Nippon Steel, you really need to come up with something other, or consider the alternative. Their argument is, if Cleveland-Cliffs purchases U.S. Steel, one company will basically own almost the entire sourcing of particular types of steel used in the automotive industry. It'll be like
do you want a monopoly
company.
Or do you want control of half of
exactly.
the monopoly?
Yeah, exactly. So that's going to be an interesting battle going forward. Yeah. Yeah. So I think that's very interesting that there's this kind of various factions forming and not necessarily in the ways we might think on that story.
And that's really fascinating. I didn't know that.
Yeah. And the other story, Powell, just today, we saw an inflation number, which, it's funny. All morning and all day, I've been seeing people analyzing it in different ways. I saw some early analysts react saying, well, it's a little hotter than we really should be. Is June still on the table for a rate cut at the Federal Reserve? And others saying, actually, it looks pretty good. It's still the core inflation figure is still inching down ever so slowly. And core inflation is more indicative of future inflation. So in any case,
can you explain what
Powell
you mean
today,
by core inflation versus core, the other
yeah.
inflation?
Okay. So core inflation removes some volatile price points, like the energy industry, food costs, things like that, so that you get a number that is more indicative of kind of like where prices are moving without those kind of volatile factors at play. So it can give you more of a kind of clearer picture of what's going on. And that's still kind of inching down very, very slowly. And the reason Kai Ryssdal's not here is because he was interviewing Federal Reserve Chief Jerome Powell, and they made news. The two of them, Powell, and getting to the actual news I was trying to tell, is today said, it's me. I'm being long-winded today. But Powell said, he interpreted it as a fairly good news, today's report, inflation report. And it's the report the Federal Reserve pays attention to more than the CPI, the Consumer Price Index. This was the Personal Consumption Expenditures Price Index. I know, a mouthful. But so that, Powell today said, still looks like they're on track to where they think they will be later this year on inflation, slowly going down.
I was on a call earlier today with some folks from Poynter, which is this journalism training organization, and an economist from Brookings, because we're getting ready to do a session to sort of help reporters talk about how to cover the economy in ways that can, you know, more deeply connect with people. And we were talking about all of this sort of uncertainty and how even though there are a lot of economic indicators moving in the right direction, people don't really trust it, right? And there's all this uncertainty. And I kind of was, well, I didn't kind of, I did. I said, I don't really think it's uncertainty as much as it's precarity. Like people feel precarious in where they are in this economy. It's like, you may be comfortable, but you feel like one thing, one change in your life could derail everything. A job loss, a health scare, your child care goes away, or you need to start taking care of an elderly parent, or you have a major problem in your house, or you need a new car. It's like, you have a good, stable situation, but you feel precarious no matter how comfortable you are. And Keith Ellis is saying history is repeating, feeling like 1992. Well, that, you know, kind of relates to the story that we were talking about yesterday where economic indicators were moving well, but people still felt the economy was bad. But in that case, the indications that, you know, the economy was strong were even stronger. and, you know, as the economist from Brookings was telling me today, she was like, you know, at all levels of the economy, things are looking significantly better than they were. And it's just that a lot of the problems we have in this economy are just annoying. Like, it is annoying to go to the grocery store and see that prices are so much higher. It doesn't mean you can't necessarily afford food, right? But anyhow, this is a whole other topic for another day. And as Craig Hilton says,
I love that framing.
Precarious.
Precarious. It really is precarity.
Yeah, I don't even know if precarity is a word, but it is now to me. Craig Hinton was saying feelings are sticky. Yes, absolutely. Allison Galensky, yes. A barge running into your bridge and, you know, disrupting the local economy of Baltimore. That's a thing that happens. Gosh, it's anyway, right. Numbers and data are not feelings. And if anything that I've learned from the folks I've been talking to these last couple of weeks is that feelings are what motivate people come election day.
Absolutely.
Okay.
They do.
So my news is completely unrelated to anything, but I have been obsessed over this article for several days now. It's from Aon, aon.co, and the headline is, "The cell is not a factory. Scientific narratives project social hierarchies onto nature. That's why we need better metaphors to describe cellular life." And wow, did this blow my mind, because yes, I have always thought of cells as factories. You know, there's a part when I think about cells, which is not often, although yes, because I know someone will inevitably bring it up. I have watched the anime series Cells at Work, which has two seasons, and it's very interesting. It's great.
And that's two references to anime in one podcast.
Oh, I we're barely halfway through, Nova. Don't worry. There will be more. But this idea that, you know, it works, the cell works like a business. There are directions going out, and one part does this and one part does that, and it's all sort of part of this grand plan, kind of top down, whatever. So I'm going to read a kind of chunky section of this, but it's interesting. "The only problem is that the cell is not a factory. It does not have a control center. As the feminist scholar Emily Martin observes, the assumption of centralized control distorts our understanding of the cell. A wealth of research in biology suggests that control and information are not restricted at the top, but present throughout the cell. The cellular organelles do not just form a linear assembly line, but interact with each other in complex ways. Nor is the cell obsessed with the economically significant work of manufacturing that metaphor of factory would have us believe. Instead, much of the work that the cell does can be thought of as maintaining itself and taking care of other cells. Why then do the standard textbooks continue to portray the cell as a hierarchy? Why do they invoke a centralized authority to explain how each cell functions? And why is the imagery so industrially loaded? And as the article goes on to say, because that is what is comfortable to a lot of the people who wrote those textbooks, who came up with these strategies of talking about it. They were men. They were in an industrial capitalist era, and they took the framework of these types of easy to understand, very in front of everyone's face, ideas to and impose them on nature. And even though they are no longer accurate, we're still using those, ideas. And when I first posted this in one of our channels on Slack that's actually shared across the company, somebody brought up that this is similar to this idea of Lynn Margulis, a evolutionary biologist who figured out that symbiosis, cooperation, is as important in evolution as is natural selection. So symbiosis is right up there with survival of the fittest, but survival of the fittest is what we pay attention to.
It's what we all talk about.
Why?
Yeah.
Right? Because that is kind of aligned with how the world, at least the human world, works. And it's just had me thinking all week about these sort of social structures that we impose on nature just to make ourselves feel comfortable understanding it. Anyway, that's
fascinating. And it also can apply, it can apply it in other areas, like the way we look at economic data, even like we make sense of it through our own lens and experience, and that can vary so greatly. And people wonder, if the facts and numbers are always the facts and numbers, then why do people differ? Because we're not looking at them with the same eyes, right?
Becca from Chicago posted in Discord, I learned today that in order to make a memory, your neurons break apart their DNA. Cells are wild. Cells just straight up hijack each other's powerhouses. Again, amazing. Science is amazing. I love this. I love good research. And I've been thinking about this and sharing this article with everyone. I'm asking people, did you read it? Did you read it? We got to talk about it because I'm a nerd, but that's okay.
Nerds rule.
Yes.
That's it for the news. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll play a round of half full, half empty. We'll be right back.
With the launch of ChatGPT, Sam Altman and OpenAI reinvigorated our imaginations and fears of a world with artificial intelligence. While the company looked like a stunning success from the outside, a battle was brewing within on what the future of AI should be. Almost a year after launching ChatGPT, that battle erupted into a war when the company fired its charismatic CEO, Sam Altman. From Wondery, Business Wars is a podcast about the biggest corporate rivalries of all time. And in the newest season, host David Brown digs into the philosophical differences within OpenAI that culminated in Sam Altman's shocking firing, the chaos that followed, and what it means for the future and safety of AI in the modern world. Follow Business Wars on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus. And for more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts, with shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Wondery means business.
Okay, we are back, and now we're going to play Half Full, Half Empty, our wonderful show hosted by the more wonderful, I was going to say equally wonderful, but no, more wonderful, Drew Jostad. Drew, take it away.
You flatter me so. Are you half full
or
half empty on Beyonce's new cover of Dolly Parton's Jolene?
I haven't heard
Randomly,
it.
Randomly, I was listening to it just before the show.
And?
I like it because, I don't know, I love adding a little bit of threatening your life into your music. So she's kind of updated the lyrics. So instead of So whereas Dolly Parton was like begging Jolene not to take her man, Beyonce is like, don't you dare or you're going to catch these hands. And I love it. Absolutely half full.
I can't comment. I haven't heard. Sorry. We only got one.
Kay Gilbert says she's full on everybody covering Jolene.
We got a lot of half fulls. Yeah. And on the YouTube stream.
I mean, I really Why want not? Beyonce to cover 9 to 5. That would bring me great joy.
Oh, yeah. I haven't heard that in a million years. That goes back. All right.
All right. Next one. So what's next, Drew?
Next up, LinkedIn is testing out short-form videos similar to TikTok or Instagram Reels. Are you half full or half empty?
Why?
Oh, God, no.
Why are they doing that? Do we know?
Because it's the growth area. Why are we doing it? Because that's where the people are.
I can find the press release for you. We are testing new ways to help members more easily discover timely, relevant videos to watch on LinkedIn.
I don't.
They're discovering new ways to keep spokesperson people on the told platform Axios. Longer. Look, short-form video keeps people on platforms longer, boosts engagement. Yeah. This is if you're trying to get young people. And young people aren't really messing around with LinkedIn. So, I mean, I get it. So, half full is a business strategy, absolutely empty in terms of my individual experience with LinkedIn.
Half empty because we have enough short form things. We need more long form things. We need to be more deliberative and think more. You know, yeah, well, half empty.
Says LinkedIn has a thin veneer of respectability for work, and they will lose that so fast if video.
Wow, that's tough. That's tough.
It's already gotten way more casual on LinkedIn since basically the Twitter masses defected over there. And,
oh, did they?
Yeah.
I didn't know that. I didn't know that's what was going on.
I think a lot of Twitter people moved over to LinkedIn in terms of regularly posting. But,
Makes sense.
What's next, Drew?
Are you half full or half empty on owning vending machines as a side hustle?
I have not heard this story, but I have a friend.
Yeah.
Who owns vending machines as a side hustle.
Really?
Yes, I do.
And how's that going?
Last time I asked him about it was pre-pandemic, and he said it was quite profitable. But, you know, it all depends on where you place them. Given the extremely limited interaction I've had with people doing this, I'll say half full. Sure, why not?
Half empty only because I'm half empty on side hustles. I don't like the term. And I don't like the idea of us needing to do that in an economy that has sprung up in an economy where people's main thing isn't paying enough. I think it's important also that when you're not working, that you do things that enrich your other parts of your life, not just your wallet. Half empty.
What if managing vending machines is your full-time job? Then what do you think of it?
It's not a side hustle. I think then you're just being an entrepreneur. And if you can make it work without price gouging people, you know, why not? Right?
I mean, I think that's how just vending entrepreneurship. Machines work is price gouge charging. Way more for the product than you would purchase. Anyway,
but there's
price gouging.
You know what
is
harsh. Yeah.
Have you ever watched Abbott Elementary?
I've watched the pilot episode, but I haven't gone past that yet.
There was a whole sort of side plot where one of the main characters was flirting with the guy who was regularly coming to restock the vending machine in the teacher's lounge, and he would make sure to stock it with the things that she liked in particular as a way of flirting with her. And it was very cute.
Great. Right, another Drew, show I have next? To catch up on.
Exactly.
All right. Next up, McDonald's announced it's going to be selling Krispy Kreme donuts in its restaurants nationwide by 2026. Are you half full or half empty?
Oh, this is a tough
one. I mean,
one.
I'm half empty on the state of the nation's cholesterol after this. but half full on the donuts, personally.
Well, why would Krispy Kreme want to sell their donuts at McDonald's? Wouldn't that potentially be a business risk?
Yeah, there's a lot more McDonald's locations than there are Krispy Kreme locations.
Yeah, yes. I suppose that's true.
I mean, this is sort of the thing when people from the South go up north. They're like, where are the Krispy Kremes? And you really can't find it because, yeah, there's not as many Krispy Kremes up north. And or at least there used to not be. And so this, I mean, as long as the quality maintains. Although I doubt McDonald's is going to have the machine where you can like get them coming off the conveyor belt. Because if you actually go to a Krispy Kreme store, there's like a light outside that tells you when the donuts have like just come off the conveyor belt.
Really?
So you know when they're like extra hot. Sorry, living
well,
out
that,
my
that, isn't that the whole point of the Krispy Kreme too? Like that they're super fresh and that's what people like?
Yeah, but I mean, I think if you're at McDonald's, you've probably signed off on your desire for freshness in your food in that particular moment. I mean,
I don't know about that.
I know they have salads.
Yeah.
But, you know, I don't
and
think
the fries
that, like,
are
having
surprisingly good.
It's yeah. I mean, look, all of this stuff is chemically engineered for us to love it. If you want to make yourself
and
really sad,
like
start reading
chemical.
The articles and the books about all of the ultra processed things that we're eating and how they're designed to make us want to eat more of them, regardless of what they do to our bodies. Anyway, half full. I love Krispy Kremes. I'm going to just say that.
Half full. Half full. I think, full. Yeah, you know, you're giving people more choices and where, you know, why not? Yeah.
Is I think it's time for the poll. Come?
Ready with
yeah.
the poll? Yeah.
All right.
Everybody in the chat,
the poll,
get ready.
Yeah, ready to vote. We'll give, what, like a minute after the question, right?
We'll see. We got to vamp for a while until people, we feel like we have good numbers.
We have enough? Okay.
Okay, right. In an investor letter on Monday, BlackRock's Larry Fink suggested raising the Social Security retirement age. Are you half full or half empty on that?
This got a lot of attention this week. This story.
Mm-hmm. Huh. Was it on our show or an? I'm
didn't
not
he
sure
suggest
quite
raising it to
it.
70? Wasn't it 70 the number he suggested?
I
Drew,
don't remember,
do you,
but oh, Drew, do you know? Yes, Drew knows all things.
I don't have it in Matt Levin's story that came out on Marketplace, so I don't know the number.
Yeah, I think it was Matt Levin's story that I was listening to, where someone suggested that maybe it should be the retirement age should be different depending on what you do for a living. Like if you're a construction worker and you've been jackhammering something for 20 years, perhaps you should be able to retire earlier or get Social Security earlier than somebody like me who's been, you know, sitting in a chair for most of my career, other than when I'm like dodging tear gas and stuff like that. But I think that changes need to happen to Social Security regardless, personally. Raising the retirement age, people are living longer, but I don't know, like 70 looks different for so many different people.
It does. You know? That's the thing. And it's not just about the work you did. You know, there's so many factors that go into
healthcare into you had access to.
Yeah. And the other element of that is there is a case to be made. There's other ways to shore up Social Security, which is there's been some research.
Cap on the tax.
Right, raise the cap on the tax. And that would, in that sense, that the cap of how much income is taxed, that if you increase the high end of the income that can be taxed. So and we're not even talking about raising the percentage of the tax. We're just talking about taxing more of upper income earning people's income. Then you would make up the shortfall. So that's a tough sell, obviously, in this country. In general, it's hard to sell people on tax increases. But it seems to me that it would be a fairly painless way to raise the tax, whereas instead of which could be far more painful, which is asking people to work much longer than they can. You know, for
yeah, Discord reasons. And YouTube chat are all on board with you when it comes to raising the cap, or there being no cap at all to Social Security income tax. And so there we are. It seems like everyone, let's see,
look at that poll.
Half empty, 76% on raising the retirement age, half full, 23%, because it seems like everyone thinks there's an obvious better solution to this problem.
And look at than Sarah Zeitz makes a good point. Longer. Yes, considering we need side hustles to survive, we should not have to wait even longer to get retirement benefits we earned. That's you know, wrapping a bow there, Sarah. Nice job. Yeah, I think it's a tough call.
Is it, though?
All right.
Is it?
Well, it's tough to figure out how to, you know, make it palatable for enough people. Yeah, enough people so that Congress will vote for it, because there's a huge portion of this country where it's a non-starter, and just is, in terms of raising taxes in any form.
Actually, I don't know if there's a huge portion of this country where it's a non-starter, because you're talking about people who are making over $170,000 who would be affected. That's not a huge chunk of the country. Yeah, I think it just happens to be the portion of the country that would be affected happens to be the portion of the country that has outsized political power and louder voices in public policy making decisions. So there's that.
Okay. There's that.
And with that, that is our show for today. We're going
to
be back.
One way to end the weekend. Yeah.
I know, right? Sorry. We're going to be back on Monday with more positivity and more ways to sort of, you know, eat the rich, I guess. In the meantime, if you have a question or a comment that you want to share with us, you can leave us a voicemail at 508-UB-SMART or emails at makemesmart@marketplace.org.
I mean, let them eat cake, you know?
No, let them eat cereal for breakfast. That's
Make
Me Smart is produced by Courtney Bergseeker. Today's episode was engineered by Charlton Thorpe. Our intern is Talia Menchaca.
The team behind our Friday game is Emily McCune and Antoinette Brock. Marissa Cabrera is our senior producer. Bridget Botnar is the director of podcasts. And Francesca Levy is the executive director of digital and on demand. And that's it for
Ryan
us.
Coleman says, cake equals Krispy Kreme. Krispy Kreme is a cake, and the cake is a lie. There we go.
I'm lost.
Me too, but that's okay. It's Friday.
Indeed.
Oh, bye, yes, everybody. Everyone says cereal for dinner, not breakfast. That was the point. It was cereal for dinner,
cereal for dinner.
Not breakfast. Yeah.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.